I just want to explain it from these points. The person who is apostate is actually disrespecting and, you know, desecrating the some kind of tenets of the religion of Islam.
Sorry, before getting into that, who do we call a murtad?
Yes, exactly. Okay. I want to, it has a lot of explanation and condition to that.
Yes.
The apostate, first of all, let me go to that issue. First of all, this person denies the tenet of the religion, like the unity of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, prophethood of noble prophet Muhammad, all the day of judgment. Okay?
Yes.
And then this person make it public. You know, this is very important. Let me explain it via a narration of the Imam As-Sadiq. He said that كُلُّ مُسْلِمٍ بَيْنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ اِرْتَدَّ عَنِ الْإِسْلَامِ وَجَّهَدَ مُحَمَّدًا نُبُوَّةَ وَكَذَّبَهُ. If you deny the prophethood of noble prophet Muhammad, if a person negate the prophethood of noble prophet Muhammad publicly, you know, these are conditions for the apostasy. It is very important. I want to say that if you want to understand whether this person is apostate or not, it is not easy. It is not easy to attribute apostasy to the an individual. First of all, as I said, it should refuse and to negate the tenet of the religion of Islam, and then to make it publicly. And the concept, and third, it is a concept of juhud and takdhib. It is very important.
Yes.
So let me explain it. Sometimes you have some doubt, some scientific, you know, you want to have some debate with some people, okay? It's okay. You want to have debate, you want to have discussion with the scholars, you have some doubts about some of the tenets of religions. All of that is granted. It's okay. Nobody have any, we cannot attribute apostasy to these people because we want to have scientific, you know, discussion here, a scholarly analysis here. This is granted. On the other hand, we have some people, they just want to have the concept of juhud, okay? Negations of the religion, tenets of religion, publicly.
Okay.
Very important. And the concept of takdhib, you know, which means to deny and to negate the prophethood of noble prophet Muhammad publicly. For example, via media, you say that I do not accept it at all. And, you know, it is not a scholarly question. It is not doubt about that. Just you want to arrogantly.
Intentionally and on purpose.
Intentionally and on
purpose.
Oppose
religion and prophets.
Not kind of opposing, but more than that, sometimes you add some kind of desecration to that.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
For example, this is like what Salman Rushdie with authoring satanic verses did on that time. And then the issue was fatwa, we can say a fatwa was issued by the late Imam Khomeini against him. That's right.
Exactly. You know, this is kind of, you know, sometimes is the case is a case of sacrilege, the case of desecration. Nobody can accept that. To desecrate any, you know, any sacred religions or the, for example, sacred books or people. But I want to emphasize on this point again and again because it is very important. The religion of Islam is a religion of intellect, the religion of wisdom. We invite all people to have conversation, to have debate, dialogue about Islamic issues. You can talk, you can have your own research about Islam, questions, anything. You know, scholarly analysis, these are acceptable and these are actually invitation from a side of Islamic scholars. But sacrilege, insults, these kind of opposition to the tenets of Islam, I think rationally speaking, nobody can accept that.
For example, the cartoons that were painted recently by Charlie Hebdo magazine in France. Yes. Is it a kind of irtidad or apostasy?
Of course, if they, if we can call it irtidad for those people who, if they are Muslim actually, or they have the background of, you know, Islam, because we
It has to be Muslim.
Exactly, because we have two kind of irtidad. First of all, fitri and milli. I do not want to go to the
No, it's good. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Because I want to know that is the person who is non-Muslim. And, for example, disrespects the saints of Islam. Is he considered as a murtad or not?
Yeah, this is not irtidad. If that person is actually is not Muslim or didn't have his parents, they were not Muslim, it is not considered to be apostasy. Rather, it is kind of, a sacrilege or kind of unbelief if you wanted to have this kind of desecration. We are talking about the Muslim or the person, his parents, they were Muslim,
Yes.
It has two categorization. And they want to revert from Islam and to oppose Islam and to come to the, unbelief. We are talking about these people. Yes.
That's all right. And the maximum punishment for a murtad in Islam is execution, isn't it?
You know, as I said, first of all, it has be if you want to recognize an individual to be apostate, extremely difficult.
Oh, this is
and very rarely it's happened that this person is apostate.
Okay.
Because in most cases, as I mentioned, they have some scientific, or they have some scholarly doubt about this issue. Oh, but they have some question in their mind. These are, imagination, this question, they are not considered to be apostasy. Or, for example, that person, maybe they are in some difficult situation. For example, in some kind of pressure, they have this kind of opposition to the religion of Islam. We are not talking about these people. Rather, we are talking in a very rare situation, some people publicly, they want to oppose Islam and to want to desecrate the tenets of religions. In that case, we have the concept of apostasy. Yes.
That's all right. So, isn't it against freedom of speech? This is, of course, a new slogan and the motto in the world. Freedom of speech, freedom of thought, or something like that. Do not ban the people from saying this, from saying that, okay? So how can Islam answer such a question?
Of course, these kind of, as I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, the freedom of thought, freedom of speech is one of the human rights. Nobody can deny that.
Yes.
But unfortunately, those people, I'm talking about some of the Western countries and governments, when they talk about the freedom of speech, even in their own country, they do not permit people to talk about certain issues.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You can have a lot of examples about that. You know that this is a political agenda.
Yes.
Yes, and this is, they do not want to defend the human right. They do not want to talk. Rather, it is they want to play by this point and by these slogans. And the reality of that, if you go, for example, even in the Islamic Republic of Iran, I think you can find the most freedom of speech because we have a lot of groups. They are opposing the government. They have some differences, debate with the government. Even with the divine religion of Islam, but they talk easily, they have debate, and they do not face any problems.
That's all right. Thank you much, Sheikh Nurmanpour, for a nice elaboration regarding the definition of apostasy and is it against freedom of speech or not. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
On February 5th, Pervez Musharraf, the four-star general who ruled Pakistan for nearly a decade, died in Dubai after a prolonged illness. He was 79 years old. Musharraf, who had been living in self-imposed exile in Dubai since 2016, seized power from former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif in a bloodless military coup in 1999. Back then, the country was almost bankrupt and the coup was almost popular.
You are aware of the developments of the past few days. These have placed increased demand on the armed forces for upholding national security and supreme national interest. The nation is looking towards you to deliver what they have been waiting for and deserve. That is justice, prosperity, and happiness.
I, General Pervez Musharraf.
On June 20th, 2001, Musharraf was sworn in as president while retaining his army chief post. A few months later, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell famously told Musharraf, "You are either with us or against us." Musharraf wrote in his autobiography, "America was sure to react violently, like a wounded bear. If the perpetrator turned out to be Al-Qaeda, then that wounded bear would come charging straight toward us." The Pakistani general announced that his country would join the so-called U.S.-led war on terror. He also allowed the U.S. to carry out air raids in Pakistan's tribal regions bordering Afghanistan and let Pakistan become a crucial transit point for NATO supplies headed to landlocked Afghanistan.
Let me right away say that Pakistan has taken a considered decision to be a part of the coalition, to be with the United States, to fight terrorism in all its forms, wherever it exists.
Meanwhile, the CIA began flying armed Predator drones from Pakistan with Musharraf's green light. According to the Washington-based New America Foundation think tank, the drones carried out over 400 strikes in Pakistan alone, killing at least 2,366 people, including 245 civilians.
We totally condemn this. The innocent people. This is very, very insulting for a country like America. The innocent persons are being targeted like this. We request them to abstain from such things.
Number one is the message to the Pakistani people that unless we come out to protect the rights of our people, no one else will defend us, certainly not this puppet leadership. And secondly, message to the Americans that this is completely counterproductive. This is only creating hatred against the Americans. This is this collateral damage, meaning killing of innocent women and children. All it is doing is helping the terrorists. It's helping Al-Qaeda. It is endangering the Americans. This is a tried and failed policy. And the whole object of this rally is to tell the Americans that, listen, time has come for a change of strategy.
Musharraf resigned as the army chief in 2007 to become president. The same year, he imposed a state of emergency in the country to suppress massive nationwide protests against his rule, marked with an iron fist and human rights violations. In December of 2007, one of his main critics, former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated in an attack in the city of Rawalpindi during an election rally. The public suspected Musharraf's hand in the killing, but he denied it.
Yes, I am telling people I have come here to Grange, and I've come here with a message of hope and peace, that it's important for us to turn the tide against militancy and extremism so that we can give our citizens security and we can address the real issues of the people, which is bread and butter issues. We want to address issues like empowerment, employment, and education.
The same year, Musharraf ordered a raid against a Red Mosque in Islamabad. It had reportedly become a sanctuary for militants opposed to Pakistan's support of the Afghanistan war. The operation, which took almost a week, killed over 100 people. The incident severely damaged Musharraf's reputation and made him the target of a series of assassination attempts. Musharraf once wrote, "I have confronted death and defied it several times in the past, because destiny and fate have always smiled on me. I only pray that I have more than the proverbial nine lives of a cat." In the general elections held in February 2008, Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party emerged victorious. Faced with the threat of impeachment, Musharraf resigned as president and left the country for Dubai. The general attempted a political comeback in 2012, but instead, he was arrested and put under house arrest, accused of treason and other charges stemming from the Red Mosque raid and Bhutto's assassination. For many of his critics, Musharraf was a typical military dictator. For others, he was a man who tried to restore the country's image as a beacon of enlightened moderation, as he used to say, and as an example of a Muslim state at ease with the demands of modernity. In the 9 years that he led Pakistan, Musharraf sometimes called himself a tightrope walker, someone who could balance opposing forces and bridge ideological divides. After a few years of being under house arrest, Musharraf was finally allowed to leave the country on bail to Dubai in 2016, presumably for medical treatment. his career ultimately ended in disgrace when he was sentenced to death in absentia for treason in 2019. Although that sentencing was later reversed, he never returned to Pakistan.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. And for my today's speak, I want to go over a new subject with the hope that it may change our vision about the problems of our life. I need to add that my talk is based on the Quran and Islamic narrations. The theme I want to talk about is a fact, which is that the scale of happiness and hardship usually stay at the same level. Or in better terminology, if we imagine that there is a scale for weighing the amount of the weight of our happiness and sadness, the two bottoms of the scale stay in the same row. In a general view, humans are all on the same level in terms of difficulty and comfort. Let me explain this point through some examples. We imagine that there are parents who have several children. Their life is very beautiful, very cheerful because of many children they have. But on the other hand, there are parents who cannot have children due to some illnesses, for example, wife is barren, whatever of medicine they can take or try to visit specialist doctors, they cannot solve the problem and they have no children. At first glance, one may say that the parents who have many children or enough children are happier and more fortunate. But if we look deeper and study the scenario, our judgment will change. Let me explain it. The parent who have children, even though they are happy, but having children confronts them with many struggles in their life. Among these difficulties, we can name the problems, the wife, the mother faces during pregnancy and delivery. The problem of children that are getting sick, sometimes the parents see that the children's illness worsens in the middle of the night, and they have to send the child or children to the hospital, the children's food and clothing expenses, the expenses of kindergarten fees, and the expenses of their education. Finally, the expenses of their marriage or the concerns that parents have about choosing a good spouse for their children. Sometimes a child may die due to illness and inflicts a lot of emotional damage on the parents. I don't want to list the problems for having children, but I just want to point to the mentioned fact that next to being happy with having a child, there exist some of the mentioned problems as well. Now, let's think about the second parents who do not have children. They may be sad about this matter, but none of the mentioned problems exist for them. They have no children, but they have also no concern about, their expenses, their illness, where to send them for education. They do not wake up at the middle of night because of the cry of the children and so on and so forth. Their life is less cheerful from this aspect, but they are free from many problems. Let's have a short break. And I will be back soon to explain this point more.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We were talking about a fact in our worldly life. The fact is that the amount of joy and sorrow of humans is often on the same level. Those who enjoy a kind of blessing, that blessing is mixed with a number of hardship, and those who are deprived from a blessing, they also are freed from a number of difficulties. This point is mentioned in one of the Imam Ali's eloquent speeches, as the Imam describes the life on this world by saying, لَمْ يَكُنْ اِمْرُؤٌ مِنْهَا فِي حَبْرَةٍ إِلَّا أَعْقَبَتْهُ بَعْدَهَا عَبْرَةٍ. No one has seen happiness in the world except that the world makes him face tears and sighs after it. فَإِنْ جَانِبٌ مِنْهَا اِعْزَوْزَبَ وَحْلَوْلَا. And if the life is sweet and pleasant on one side, أَمَرَّ مِنْهَا جَانِبٌ فَأَوْبَا. It will bring bitterness and create death on the other side. Then the Imam continues, وَلَا يَنَالُ امْرُؤٌ مِنْ غَزَارَتَهَا رَغَبًا إِلَّا أَلْحَقَتْهُ مِنْ نَوَائِبِهَا تَعْبًا. No one gets what he wants from the blessing and pleasure of the world, unless sooner or later the world will make him suffer from its problems and hardships. There are many examples for, getting your mind closer to the point that the scale of hardship and happiness usually is the same. For instance, if we compare a married couple with someone who has not yet married. As marriage has its own benefit, remaining single and its own relaxation and rest. And as being single is resultant in some difficulties, getting married accompanies with its hardship. For example, the one who is single can decide for himself or herself, but a couple needs to come to the conclusion in many issues. A couple's expenses of life is higher, but a single one should be just worried about his own expenses. Another example. For instance, we can consider someone who has a lot of wealth and property, that if we compare it with another one who has less money, we see that having a lot of wealth makes the mind of the owner busier with how to protect his money, how to invest it. Even if there is a loss in a transaction or a loss in a stock exchange, the one who has a lot of money sustains more loss than the one who has less money. Indeed, having a lot of wealth for his turn makes the life easier in many cases. In another example, the one who is genius and has a powerful intellect, he has many worries about every details in his life. But the one whose intellect is not that much functional, next to not being genius, he has less concern about a number of things in his life. Let's come to the conclusion. Just as a couple who have children, when they face a severe problem about their children and their mind is totally involved with that problem, for example, when they miss one of their children, just as they think those who have no children are happier, on the other hand, those who have no children think those who are bestowed with many children are happier and their life is more cheerful. This is a normal fact about our life in this world. If we have this vision about our life, we would become more satisfied with our destiny, with our fate, and do not regret others who enjoy a blessing, since everyone has his own happiness and his own hardship. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
Everyone has a beloved. And you, dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Assalamu alaikum, Professor.
Alaikum assalam.
We have been talking about dignity in relation to parents and children. Now, we have some audience questions wherein they are mostly mothers. There's a mother who says that I often have fights with my husband just because he either screams or beats my son in front of guests. So I would want you to have some advices for him.
So this is a very pertinent question regarding the maintenance of dignity of each other, especially the parents. So one thing which is important to make us, and we should understand that if we're to, the way we behave in between ourselves as parents, as spouses, as partners in front of our children, they'll just learn to behave in the same manner with us and with others. So.
Yeah.
So number one, the first consideration should be that the way we speak with each other, to each other, should be in a polite way, in a loving way, in a caring way, showing our love and respect for each other, caring for each other's feelings and thoughts. And if there is a difference of opinion, we should try to resolve that in a very amicable way. So that is basically what should be done. Now, if there's one of them, especially the husband, who does not even take care of the respect and honor of his wife in front of his guests, then that is a very, very negative attitude, and this has to be. It has to be curtailed, it has to be stopped, it has to be somehow
solved.
And the important thing is, yes. Now, the best way, step number one would be If you are going to shout back and you're going to start to fight back, then the situation is going to become worse. So the first thing is let things cool down. If both of the sides start screaming at each other, then we will have a real fight. But as we always say, clapping is not possible without two hands. If one of us is getting upset or uptight about something and we're losing our temper, the other one should keep his cool or her cool and remain quiet, at least. If he or she cannot say something to soothe the other person, then at least one should keep quiet and not to feel offended or not to show his. Yes, the expression should show that we're not feeling good about it, but we should not fight back or try to give a reaction. A knee-jerk reaction would not be called for. So therefore, step number one, keep your cool. Don't let things get out of hand, especially in front of guests. And or even much better would be somehow say something in a way that makes him realize his mistake. And to, with love and care, I'm sorry if I accept your mistake, even if you're not, even if you've not made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
For example, he says, you bring in fruit for the guests and it's the salt is too much or too little. And he starts saying, oh, what the hell, how bad food you've made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, it may be bad, it may not be good, so the wife can accept that, yes, sorry, I was in a hurry or I made a mistake, I'm sorry about that. So you can cool down the situation by offering your apologies. That would certainly make the person realize that it shouldn't be continued.
All right. Well, Professor, we'll continue the discussion after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, we said that there's a father who misbehaves with a child in front of guests. You first of all said if the person is used to misbehaving with a wife, how he can tackle it or how she can actually tackle it. And now let's go back to how he can tackle the child in a better way or how this mother can behave or act there. The first thing you told us over here is that she has to maintain her cool.
Yes, she. Of course, there are two things which have to be taken care of. Number one, whether it's in front of guests or whether it is alone. In both cases, one thing is for sure that at least the importance of the husband or the father should be kept protected by the family. I mean, the wife can play the most important role by maintaining the position and the status, as we said, as the husband or the father has the position of the head of the family. So he is the head of the family by virtue of the fact that he is the bread earner and he has to take care of the family. So that position should not be jeopardized. So that is one principle or issue that has to be kept in mind by all the family. And the best person who can do that is the wife. So whether it's a misbehavior by the husband with respect to the wife or its misbehavior by the father to the children, in front of other children, in front of other guests, or even alone. Here, the wife cannot should not start reacting to what he is doing. Of course, there may be a situation where the husband starts hurting the child or hitting him.
Yeah.
Or giving him a spank or something. Oh, if it's just a spanking, he's telling it.
Something in a loud tone.
To the extent that it is allowed, so that's not a problem. But if he's really in anger and he has lost his temper and he has felt offended by something that the child has done, now this is a difficult situation. He is not doing the right thing.
Yeah.
He is not expected to do that. But again, if the wife starts reacting to it, that will make the situation worse. So she has to somehow, number one, maintain that honor and respect of the husband and the father, and somehow take the child out of way of harm, out of the way of harm, and to somehow...
So if he's getting hit by father or getting slapped or something, she has to save him without...
Shield him to in some
without
way.
Without just reacting much, without...
Yes.
In a very lower tone, yes, she can actually... Yes.
She should come express. In between and say, okay, ask her child to leave the room maybe. So the situation is controlled and tells the husband, okay, and let's resolve this alone and let him be. But again, there's another issue. Yes, the temper, the losing of the temper by the father is not justified.
Except
but yes, but even then, there are some things that children may do which are really bad, really evil, really wrong.
And you are actually very sensitive when it comes to guests. You want everything to be okay, everything to be nice and normal, and then kids come in and they destroy it, and then
yes.
You also lose temper. So it's a very important topic. We'll discuss more on it after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi, you were saying that if a child is being accused in the family, in front of guests, especially by the father, you said that first thing, sometimes children do certain things that a father is forced to, but you said he's only authorized what is allowed. He can actually maybe actually make his tempo or voice a little louder, but not hit the child or slap a child.
Of course, and then again, if the mother wants to intervene, so she has to be a little very careful about two things. Number one, as I said, the position and status of the father should not be hurt. Number two, it should not seem that the mother is defending his or her child regarding that offense. It may be something really wrong. It shouldn't seem that she is letting him off or trying to justify what the wrong deed he has done. No, that should also not be the case.
So here again, balance comes in between.
Yes, that's a very tricky situation. The child should not feel that I'm being shielded by or defended my mother so I can do whatever wrong I can.
She
wanted.
Defended me.
So that is also a very difficult situation where you need to be very careful. So number one, the father should be, of course, in front of guests and such a scolding, such a
hitting the child.
It shouldn't be at all allowed. It shouldn't be, taken into consideration at all. The situation should be kept very, very cool and very in a relaxing manner. It should be taken care of. But normally, children don't do such things in front of guests. They may make a mistake. They may not be eating what they should be eating properly, or they should take care of manners, or not speaking properly, or speaking out of line where they're not supposed to say anything. They start interjecting and they start disturbing the something which they're not in a position to say. So parents can get offended and say, "Oh, keep out of this." No, that should not be the case. Why not let them get involved? If everybody's sitting, then let us talk about something which everyone can participate in, and give the children some
space
to give their opinions. And that would be something which would offer you a situation where you can rectify them later on.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. The audiences, we have been discussing about the dignity and honor in relation to parent and children. And here we had a question which said that mother is... And here we had a question where a mother said that she gets often upset when she sees her husband scolding her child in front of guests. And Professor said... whether there are some men that, who often scold even mothers in front of guests. So Professor started with how this mother can behave as a wife, as a mother herself, and how she can actually balance things. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening. In case you want to listen to our program again, please go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab COI Call of Islam and you can find all our programs there. You can also find us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam. If you had any questions, any more queries, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Muhammad, the seal of all prophets. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced, and Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him, his progeny, performed such rituals. Religions appeared one after another. All of them represented one God, one path, one origin, and one end to mankind. Every messenger who was appointed by God to convey his message informed the people of the advent of the last prophet of God. In this sense, Buddha and Krishna said the very same thing which Noah, Abraham, Moses, John, Zoroaster, and Jesus said. One told the name of the final prophet, and the other spoke of his origin. One forecast the signs of his homeland, while the other described the characteristics of his language. In one way or another, each prophet informed mankind of the joyous news of the advent of the final prophet, the last messenger of the heavens. In the very beginning of history, God sent Adam, his first prophet on earth, to propagate and show the heavenly path to the inhabitants of this world. Thousands of years have passed ever since, and some people continue to follow him by residing exclusively near the riverbanks of the world. Zoroastrianism is one of the most ancient religions of the world. These days, most of its followers are found in Iran, India, and some regions of Central Asia. They possess a heritage several thousand years old. Like the prophets before him, Zoroaster also informed his followers of the coming of divine prophets. The religious scripts of Zoroastrianism refer to these messengers as Sotients. There are three Sotients who were foretold to appear after the Zoroaster. Alternatively, three Sotients, three beneficent personalities, will come one after the other. Throughout history, the followers of Zoroaster have been waiting for their arrival. They have searched for them everywhere.
Attilo! What brings you here?
They are visitors from the east. They follow the star. The star of the prophecy.
The prophecy of the Messiah?
The Messiah!
So far, only three Zoroastrian sages have succeeded in seeing the first Sotient in Bethlehem. When the last prophet of God appeared in Hejaz, there were many Zoroastrians who saw the signs of the second Sotient in him. They joined him in large numbers and became his followers and helpers. However, there are still many Zoroastrians who are keenly waiting for the arrival of the third Sotient. They hope that this universal reformer will appear and make the world a utopia. In India, the land of many creeds, there are several mysterious religions spread out in the vast jungles and mountainous regions. You find religions such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Sikhism. Though in some case, the followers of these religions have become deviated from the right path. The depth of meaning and spirituality that these religions reveal is indicative of man's inherent tendency to establish a close relationship with an infallible creator and worship him. Historical roots of Hinduism are spread over thousands of years. Mysterious ascetics with wonderful conducts live all over India, in colorful shrines and dark temples in legendary jungles. They make the unspeakable things of this mysterious land even more mysterious.
God is one only. Even in India, in the Hindu philosophy, God is always one. But his manifestation is many.
This historical religion has several holy books as guidelines for its followers. These books are full of strange and unsaid mysteries. Among the sacred books of Hindus are the Puranas. These ancient books contain the history of the universe, the genealogy of kings and heroes, and the foretelling of future events. In these books, we again witness indications of the coming of a spiritual teacher called Muhammad from a foreign land. To him is what Raja Bhuj respectfully says. I prostrate myself before you, O you, the pride of mankind, the inhabitant of Arabia. You have gathered a great power to eradicate Satan.
In one of the Puranas in India, Bhavishya Purana, it is also mentioned that Mahamud, Paigambar Muhammad, will be born in the Middle East and he would cleanse the people of corruption and bad habits there, and you know, he will bring a new wave of devotion. This is mentioned thousands of years ago in the Hindu texts, in a Purana. It's one verse is there, one quote is there, that such and such a person, a prediction was done about that.
He will appear in a sandy desert in the land of Arabia. He will be known as the pride of humanity, and his name is Muhammad. What could be the secret that has been also mentioned in the holy books of Hindus, and of which the Hindu monks have spoken? The history of Jainism goes back about 600 years before the appearance of Christ. According to Jainism, salvation can only be achieved through the practice of asceticism. The tenets of this faith dictate that God has 24 avatars on earth. The last one of them will be born in a peninsula, and the name of his father is Vishnu Bhagat, which is the equivalent of Abdullah. And the name of his mother is Somanib, which is the equivalent of Amina. He is said to be taught by Bhagwan in a cave. Sikhs, who wear a unique turban on their head, are followers of another religion in India. But are there any hints about the Holy Prophet of Islam and his religion in the scriptures of Sikhs? In addition to the promise made thousands of years ago by Eastern religions concerning the advent of a prophet called Muhammad in Arabia, Abrahamic religions also foretell the arrival of a great prophet on earth in the last age of humanity. Moses and Jesus endured many difficulties on the path of propagating their messages. They promised the people about the advent of a man from among the descendants of Abraham. The New Testament clearly promises the arrival of a prophet after Christ. An example of this can be seen in the Gospel of John. Shortly before the advent of Christ, Roman oppression was continuously increasing. More and more innocent people were crucified every day. And the poor were made even poorer through forced taxes. In such conditions, a man called John, from the shores of the Jordanian River, claimed prophecy. He kindled both doubt and hope in the hearts of the Jews of his time. Perhaps they wondered whether he was Messiah, the prophet foretold to end pain and tragedy. On the same day, Jewish leaders sent a group of Levites to John to investigate the matter.
Who are you?
John confessed. He did not deny. He answered,
I am not the Messiah,
Who are you?